We're ready to hear from you.
Thank you.
Thank
Good
you.
Morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
My name is David Lane. Seated at council table with me is my first assistant, Andrew Guilty, from the law firm of Kilmer Lane and Newman. May it please the court. This case presents this court with some extremely interesting issues of first impression for the Tenth Circuit.
I thought the way I did it, I said we have a constitutional tiger by the tail.
Well, that is clearly one way to put it, and I don't blame Your Honor for putting it that way. The easy issue in this case is the Fourth Amendment issue. And at the outset, I'm going to concede that these officers had an absolute right to pull their guns and detain Mr. Sandberg upon their initial contact with him. And the only reason I say that is because the 911 call alleged possible workplace violence along with a man carrying a gun. If it had simply been a report of a man carrying a gun, I would be taking a completely different position on that one. But the combination of the two, I have to concede, they have a right to detain him and disarm him. So from there, the case moves forward into a little bit easier territory, and that is all applicable case law says a brief investigatory detention is permissible. But what we have here is a motion to dismiss filed by the defendants in the court below, granted by Judge Arguello, and that's where she goes wrong, because did we sufficiently plead this case or did we not sufficiently plead this case?
Well, to sufficiently plead this case on the Fourth Amendment claim, you have to show that there was an absence of probable cause for disorderly conduct, right?
Yes.
And where have you identified in your appeal briefs, in district court, the ordinance for disorderly conduct in the city of Englewood?
Well, that is, actually, it's they didn't charge him with a municipal ordinance violation.
So it was the statute.
The state statute.
And so where have you identified that in your appeal brief, that it was the statute that was, that underlay the prolonged stop?
It's not. And
so how can we reverse, based on the absence of probable cause, for a violation, for a, let's say it's an arrest, for an arrest for violation of the state disorderly conduct statute, when you haven't identified the statute and you haven't identified the elements of the disorderly conduct statute?
The way we get around that is to simply look at the face of the complaint. In the complaint, it's alleged that, in the fact section, that he was ultimately given a summons for disorderly conduct. But we repeatedly state in the fact section of the complaint, he had undertaken no action of any kind which would have led to any criminal liability whatsoever. That covers everything from murder to disorderly conduct.
Well, by conceding, though, and that it strikes me, that is, by conceding the validity of the Fourth Amendment initial arrest, are you basically diffusing your Second Amendment claim? It's no longer before us square on, right? Because had the defendant, as you say, been stopped solely for carrying a gun in Colorado in a public space and permissibly, we have a very crisp Second Amendment violation case in which we have to determine whether there is a constitutional violation and whether the law was clearly established on that point, at the point of arrest. But would you say, well, the situation is blurred because we concede that the arrest was proper because of the additional element here, which may or may not have been enough, I don't know, but you say it is, so we're going to accept that concession. It seems to me that then the Second Amendment case only becomes viable peripherally.
Well, I think we're splitting hairs here.
Appellate practice is about splitting hairs.
It's true. It was not an arrest. We are not saying that Mr. Sandberg was arrested initially. And in fact, he was stopped for a brief investigatory detention, which is different. All you need is reasonable suspicion to get there.
Right.
They had reasonable suspicion that maybe this guy had engaged in workplace violence. And under Terry versus Ohio, they have a right to be safe while they're doing this brief investigatory detention. They see the handgun, they take it from him. There is nothing in the record, contrary to what appellees argue, that he was ever even handcuffed. He was simply sitting in a chair in the auto store, in the repair store, for 4 hours while they allegedly investigated. It would have possibly been a cleaner Second Amendment issue, but what ultimately happened is the city attorney told them, well, if someone was alarmed by his simply carrying a gun legally, then, as a prosecutor friend of mine says, when there is no crime, there is disorderly conduct. So let's just charge him with disorderly conduct, which is exactly what they did, despite the fact that...
Well, wasn't there a basis for that charge? Mr. Wells was upset by it. He saw this guy rolling down the street with weapons and thought, what in the world's going on, and dials 911.
Where you're going with that is the upshot of that argument would be, if you are engaged in completely and totally legal conduct, maybe it's standing on the street corner condemning the President of the United States in a fiery speech, and someone is alarmed, then that person goes to jail for disorderly conduct. Well, that can't be the law.
Well, I think it is. Under 18-9-106, the Colorado statute that you have, I think, have now said was the predicate for the prolonged...
That was the predicate.
The prolonged stop. Says a person commits disorderly conduct if he or she intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly, not being a peace officer, displays a deadly weapon, which he did, displays any article used or fashioned in a manner to cause a person to reasonably believe that the article is a deadly weapon. And then it's a disjunctive, and it goes on.
Are you reading from 106?
Yeah, 18-9-106, 1F.
All right.
And so he was displaying a deadly weapon, which by statute would cause alarm to a third person, which obviously did, to the 911 caller. And so it wasn't like he was simply carrying out perfectly legal conduct. He was specifically violating what was prohibited in the statute.
Is that a constitutional statute?
That is not a constitutional statute if the conduct that alarms someone is legal conduct.
Well, that's your Second Amendment claim.
Yes.
Right.
Well,
that wouldn't have precluded your Fourth Amendment claim.
It's not necessarily a Second Amendment claim. It's a claim that, as my law partner Daryl Kilmer has said, you can do anything unless you can't. Meaning, you can carry a weapon in Inglewood, Colorado, because the government has never said you can't. He is engaged in completely legal conduct. And if that statute criminalizes perfectly legal conduct, then that statute, the way it is being applied in this particular instance, is unconstitutional. That's our response to that. And it's not necessarily a Second Amendment issue. It is a Colorado state law statute, meaning the state law says you can open carry. If the city of Inglewood's good with it, the state of Colorado's good with it. So it's not necessarily Second Amendment. The Second Amendment, though, can come into this case the way we have inserted it, which is not only is this a violation of the Fourth Amendment because he was engaged in no criminal conduct, which we have specifically pled in this complaint, in the four corners of the complaint, not only is he having his Fourth Amendment rights violated, but we are arguing that the Second Amendment to the United States Constitution, after Heller, personalizing the right to protect yourself in your home by keeping a firearm.
Well, cautious where you tread, because that is the distinction upon which some circuits have said that it's limited to your home. And your client was not in his home.
Correct.
He was out in public.
And all we can do is fall back on the dissent filed by Justice Gorsuch and Justice Thomas in Peruta, saying that it is highly unlikely, given the nature of a personalized right to keep arms in your home, that the right to bear arms is simply limited to carrying your firearm from your bedroom to your kitchen. The right to keep and bear arms logically means if you're going to bear arms, that means in self-defense because it's a personalized right. It's not having anything to do with a militia, apparently, whether you agree with that or not.
they say.
Yeah, a well-regulated.
Yes.
Yes.
March with a group.
Yeah.
So what if
that ship has sailed?
So what if I'm walking around and let's say if there's a Second Amendment right to open carry, and I walk around with a pistol in a holster and a knife in my belt, just as this gentleman did, and I'm playing with it, I'm pulling it up, put my hand on the handle of the pistol. You're saying that if I get stopped for disorderly conduct, or even arrested for disorderly conduct, that's a violation because I have a right to open carry. Does that mean that you can do anything with the weapon as long as you're openly carrying the weapon?
No, there are laws against brandishing, for example. You are not allowed to pull out your gun, fire three rounds into the air to celebrate the 4th of July. You're not allowed to point it at people. Flourishing a weapon is illegal.
And this gentleman was stopped, kept, not for openly carrying a weapon, because there was a 911 caller that had expressed alarm that this person had been engaged in workplace violence.
Right.
And so why wasn't it, even if there is a constitutional right to open carry, why wasn't it not an intrusion into that right to simply keep someone for long enough to make sure that that person had not been engaged in workplace violence, that had not been brandishing the weapon and the like?
That's fine. They can do a brief investigatory detention based on the possibility that workplace violence had occurred. But we specifically plead in our complaint that once the police arrived, and they disarmed Mr. Sandberg, they then talked to Mr. Wells, who was the 911 caller, and they determined that the whole basis for his 911 call is simply carrying the weapon on his holster. He had no information about any workplace violence. They did a full investigation. They talked to the man in the auto parts store. They talked to Mr. Wells. They then determined, and it's a fair reading of our complaint, not a hyper-technical reading, which is required by the court below, where we're supposed to list what time every incident occurred.
Well, but we don't need to know what time every incident occurred by precision, but we do have to know in general at what point were these factual determinations made vis-a-vis his ultimate release.
Well,
4 hours. Intervened in that time, but we don't know how much of that time was filled with these calls.
Well, what we have here in paragraph 34 of the complaint, after detaining Mr. Sandberg, searching him and seizing his property, Officer Johnson proceeded to contact Mr. Wells. Mr. Wells explained to Officer Johnson that he had seen Mr. Sandberg carrying his firearm in the holster on his hip, and the first thing he thought of was workplace violence. Mr. Wells did not relay any information to Officer Johnson that would cause him to believe that Mr. Sandberg had violated any law, including disorderly conduct by implication, or threaten the safety of any person. That is a well-pled complaint. That we don't have to say 3 minutes and 32 seconds after the officers arrived, this happened. Our client was detained.
No, but follow through my decision tree here. The Second Amendment guarantees to every citizen the right to bear arms and the predicate on the predicate basis stated, et cetera. That is not clearly established yet under the various circuits of the United States or by the United States Supreme Court as to whether the facts under this case would constitute, assuming nothing more, would constitute a violation of the Second Amendment. So that's a difficult question then. But then you make it a lot easier by saying, oh, well, we concede that they had a reasonable basis for the stop. Now, at that point, we're no longer on the Second Amendment. We're now switching to the Fourth Amendment and the reasonableness of the duration of the stop.
Well, there's
that we're talking about. So it seems to me on that point, you've got to bear the burden to establish that the duration was unreasonable. How do we know that if we don't know these other timelines?
Because a fair reading of the complaint is after they detained him and searched him, they went and talked to Mr. Wells. A normal reader would conclude that happened.
How do we know that didn't take 3 hours and 59 minutes later, one minute before he was released.
A normal reading of the English language is simply that, you know, this is the chronology of what happened. And despite that, we say, they kept him for 4 hours while they were, quote, trying to figure out what to charge him with.
When you say kept him for 4 hours, that 4 hours is from the initial detention to his release.
Yes.
And we, as Judge Lucero has asked, we don't know where within that period of time they had sufficient information that you would argue should have caused him to be released.
All I can say is, because we're limited to the four corners of the complaint here, in the complaint, when you read the complaint, the normal reading of the chronology is after they searched and detained him, we didn't then allege that they went and had a coffee break or did anything else. They talked to Mr. Wells, and they made this determination. Finally, my client, Mr. Sandberg, said, when am I free to go? And they said, sit tight. We're still trying to figure out what to charge you with. And finally, after talking to the city attorney, they then, after 4 hours, finally said, we're charging you with disorderly conduct, and the charges were dismissed.
Thank you. My time
is up, and thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
May it please the court, I'm Tom Rice, and I'm here today on behalf of all of the appellees. If I could, I would like to start with the issue of the prosecutorial immunity, because I think that's very important with regard to Defendant Comer in this case. Important in the complaint, there's no allegation whatsoever that Mr. Comer was engaged in investigation, or for that matter, that he was advising people on investigation. Instead, the only allegation against Comer is that he was called by the police, they provided him with some background as to what they were finding out, and then he made a suggestion to them about what would be an applicable charge. Now, that strikes me as being a quintessential prosecutorial function, where he's taking fact, applying law to it, and deciding what would be an appropriate charge under those circumstances. Using the continuum approach that this court has adopted with regard to this issue of immunity, the question becomes how close to the judicial function was the activity of the prosecutor. And in this case, the prosecutor was right there on the precipice of charges being brought in court and his advice on that, which strikes me as being very close, and therefore Comer should be out of this case entirely based upon the absolute immunity.
Well, at the point at which the city attorney says, charge him with disorderly conduct, the only facts upon which he could be charged with disorderly conduct were carrying a gun in a holster, because these other scenarios that Judge Bachrach advances is all hypothetical. There is no such evidence in this case. There's no brandishing. There's no threatening. There's no anything.
Agreed. The question is whether or not he displayed a deadly weapon in such a fashion that it would alarm. Okay, that's the question. And we're not asking here whether or not he can be proven beyond a reasonable doubt to be guilty of that crime. The question is whether or not there are sufficient facts that could be argued that that's the case.
Farmer Joe may be driving down the road in his pickup truck and the gun in the window. His wife, Mabel Joe, may be carrying a gun, shooting at rabbits or whatever. You can't tell me that the law is that if somebody is of timid mind is alarmed by seeing somebody carrying a gun, that that's enough to charge him with disorderly conduct.
No, it's actually, under the statute, it's an objective determination anyway. So the question isn't whether someone was subjectively alarmed. The question is whether or not, arguably, from an objective standpoint, someone would be alarmed. And so here this gentleman who made the report is at his place of business, and he sees someone go walking by with a pistol on his hip, and the first thing he's thinking of is there's something afoot here. There's violence in the workplace here, and so he places the 911 call. Now, again, certainly an argument can be made that that's lawful activity and no objective person would believe that to be the case, but that's not the question. The question is whether or not they had sufficient facts.
Well, it's not the question only because of plaintiff counsel's honorable conduct in saying that because these other facts may exist, we have to unfortunately make that concession. But for that concession, that question would be presented in this case.
Mm-hmm. But bringing it back to the context of the prosecutorial immunity, the question is not whether or not he gave good advice. The question is whether or not the advice he was giving was a part of his function as a judicial officer. And so when he's taking fact and applying it to law and providing advice about charges that should be brought, it seems to me that he's squarely within the immunity that's provided to prosecutors.
Right. My comments were to the delay, not to the ultimate decision.
Sure. Now, the Second Amendment issue, and I share in Judge Lucero's comments about that, that it becomes a different question once we have this concession made with regard to the Fourth Amendment issue. But I think that in this case, we need to keep some things in mind in terms of whether or not there was a Second Amendment violation. This would be a very poor case to lay down a precedent that you have a ability to open carry in the state of Colorado. And let me explain why I say
well,
that.
Well, I don't want to cut off your explanation about why it would be bad, but I hope in your answer you'll tell us how we can avoid the question, because the municipality is sued, so it's not solely a question of qualified immunity.
Well, that's assuming that there are sufficient allegations made with regard to the municipal liability, because if there aren't, then you don't have to reach it in that event either. But in this particular case, we don't have a true carrying a firearm in public place. Okay, we're on private property here. All right, and by the plaintiff's own concession, any of those people that own that property could have told him, "No, you can't have a gun here."
He didn't go from Epic Autos to 7-Eleven with a pistol in his holster.
But he was walking by the adjacent business owner, as I read the complaint, when he was alarmed the neighbor.
I thought he was on the sidewalk. I thought he was in the public area.
It's not alleged to be a public sidewalk. There's nothing in the complaint that would tell us he's on
public sidewalks in front of businesses in this city, usually public.
Well, it depends on whether or not it's on the city property or it's on the private property.
How close he was to the building, you mean?
Sorry?
How close he was walking to the building?
Well, I mean, like, take a shopping plaza. You're going to have private roads and private sidewalks within that are not going to be public property.
Okay. Did you argue this in your brief?
Oh, but I'm answering the question.
Oh, about, sorry.
I'm trying to, respond to your question of why this would not be a good case. So they concede that if he's on private property, he has no right to carry a firearm.
I beg your pardon. What did you just say?
They concede that if he's on private property, he doesn't have a constitutional right to carry a firearm.
I don't know that they made any such concession. I think what he said is that he had asked for permission to come into the auto business with a gun, and that the owner of the business or an agent of the business said yes. Now, I don't know that constitutes a concession that you had to ask the tavern owner for permission to carry the gun, although in the Old West they did have a sign that said, please check guns at the bar. So maybe the Constitution should be interpreted under the laws that it existed at the time the founders wrote it, and I don't know what they did in the saloons in those days. We'd have to check it out.
But of course, the Second Amendment wouldn't constrain private actors anyway. So if I said I didn't want anybody in my house with a gun, the Second Amendment wouldn't prohibit me from doing that. And so what we have here is a case where it's not even clear that he's on public property. The other thing is that I will disagree a little bit with Mr. Lane. Colorado doesn't expressly allow open carry. It simply doesn't have a law that prohibits you from doing so.
Well, it's interesting that the Colorado Constitutional Amendment on arms, unlike a lot of the amendments to the Colorado Constitution that parallel the federal Constitution, this, I was struck by what substantially different
yes.
declaration the second, end quote, amendment rights under the Colorado Constitution are. They're very different.
But then the law that's really in question here, the so-called open carry law, is a statute that says if a municipality wishes to, they can prohibit carrying in certain areas.
And they have
But then they have to put up signs.
Right?
You have to put up signs.
Right.
But this is a 1983 action where the allegation is the violation of constitutional rights. So I thought we were talking about the federal constitution.
Sure, we are.
Only?
Yeah.
Okay. But
well, no, not only. He pled the Colorado Constitution, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. But that's got also a weakness to it in the sense that the Colorado courts have consistently held that there's no private right of action for damages under the Colorado Constitution.
But he's only in court if you took all the other constitutional violations away, that is, the federal constitutional violations away. He's only in court on the Colorado Constitution Second Amendment if he's in court on the federal Second Amendment.
Correct.
Okay.
Right. But so this case is not a good case for making a determination about whether or not under the Second Amendment we are going to allow open carry in an unfettered way. And no court has ever decided that. I mean, the closest that has come is the Seventh Circuit case in Madigan, which was a 2-1 decision, I might add. And so that's clearly not, in my view, established law. When we look at it, just one decision with a split panel. And we've got other circuits that are deciding just the opposite. And the counsel we have from the Supreme Court on Heller and McDonald is, in my view, they were very careful to say, in the home.
Right. Well, those are that's the clearly established prong that we were talking about earlier, and that's a thornier question.
Yeah. Well, if this court is to address the issue of whether or not such a right exists, I just don't think this is a good case to do it. I would also say that on a motion to dismiss record, it's not a good idea to decide such important constitutional rights when the facts haven't even really been established in the case.
Yeah, I don't understand that logic. I mean, that logic seems to cut against you. In other words, I'm intrigued by the notion that we can avoid deciding whether there is a Second Amendment right to open carry. But the arguments that I hear you say is, one, two justices out of nine say that there's a constitutional right to open carry. We don't know about the other seven. We know that you think the allegation about a municipal policy or custom is conclusory.
Yes.
They rely on Mr. Comer's exercise of his prosecutorial discretion, as you've elucidated, in saying, well, the law is that if you openly carry, if he's displaying a weapon, and he caused alarm to somebody, then that's a violation of the disorderly conduct statute. And so they say, well, that's a pretty good indicia, at least out on 12b-6 standard, that there's that's why he thinks that there's a municipal policy or custom. And you say, third, that, well, he was actually closer to the private property, but the only thing we have to go on is what counsel had said in oral argument. You don't have anything in the briefs. You haven't identified anything in the record about it. And then, so then your last argument is, well, it's on a 12b-6. Well, as opposing counsel indicated, we have to liberally construe the allegations in the light most favorable to the pleader, not to say, well, look, we don't like this Second Amendment issue, so, and we don't have any developed facts, so, you know, we'll just say we're going to cut it off at the pass. Yeah. Those don't seem like persuasive arguments to avoid the issue.
It's their burden on the 12b-6 issue to plead the facts sufficient to show that they have a constitutional right. That's their burden. It's not ours to show that they haven't pled sufficient facts. And in this case, our record, for all practical purposes, is that complaint. And the complaint doesn't say that he was on public property in the sense that government property. So that's why I'm saying that this is not a good case, because you don't have a good record upon which to make a clean determination of such an important constitutional right. While we're on the municipal liability issue, let me just talk about that for a couple of minutes, if I could. I think we all agree that in a single instance kind of case, it's very difficult to get a municipal liability claim except under very specific circumstances. And in this particular case, for example, they would want to say that this is a repetitive pattern, and they've alleged that, but there's not even a single allegation of another case where this happened in Englewood, not referenced to one single other case. So we truly have a one-instance situation. And then they try to get around that by saying, well, gee, these two guys were final policymakers, and so therefore it gets past the exception for the single instance case. And the problem with that is that other than conclusory statements that they were final policymakers, there's no facts that put meat on that bone.
Well, you started the first 5 minutes of your argument saying that Mr. Kober is exercising his prosecutorial discretion as someone with expertise in applying the law.
In this particular case, yes, that he was providing his advice as to what would be an applicable charge.
Yeah, and so he tells the officers that, well, then he's violating the disorderly conduct statute. They apply it. And then, so they recite that in paragraph 47 of their complaint. So I don't understand how you can have your cake and eat it too with prosecutorial immunity and say, but he's just Mr. Comer. He doesn't really, he's not a high-ranking guy. He doesn't really have authority.
But I think there's a different thing to say that I think that this charge would be applicable in this case versus all people who come into Englewood with firearms openly displayed should be arrested. Okay, those are two different things. And that's what they're arguing for as the policy, is that anybody who open carries in Englewood should be charged. And that's not established by anything that's been pled in this particular case. The other thing is that just the mere idea that the city attorney supervises the police, I mean, that seems to be antithetical to the way these things usually work, and so there needs to be some allegations to support that. So I see I'm red-lighted here. A very interesting discussion. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments this morning. The case is submitted.